Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Tim Wilson makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute as a speaker, that is. He's been to quite a few of our functions over the years. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. He was educated at Monash University. He worked at the Australian APEC Study Centre on areas of international aid. He worked in consulting in the area of communications, then at the IPA, and most recently in the last few months as the Human Rights Commissioner. And Mr. Wilson tonight's going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of freedom wars or the 21st century contest of ideas. And as you know, we had Professor Gillian Triggs here some months ago. We've had George Brandeis here. And in the current series, the Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson. Tim, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared. Thank you very much for that kind introduction and that warm round of applause. First, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are traditional owners of the lands on which we are meeting tonight. I also want to acknowledge the Sydney Institute. In your 25th year, I want to express my personal congratulations to the Institute, its membership, which includes, I'm sure, many of you, and its founders, particularly Anne and Jared. The Sydney Institute is a lighthouse that guides the debate underpinning Australian democracy. The country is stronger for having the Institute. Congratulations on your 25 years and good wishes for the many more that I hope will come. Thank you all, of course, for coming tonight to come and hear my first major address as Australia's Human Rights Commissioner. I know the temptation of the budget must have been at least there. The position of a Human Rights Commissioner is established under the Australian Human Rights Commission Act. There are currently 8 commissioners at the Commission, which include the President and commissioners that focus on discrimination on the basis of age, race, sex and disability. There's also the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner and the Children's Commissioner. And then there is my office, the Human Rights Commissioner. My role of the Human Rights Commissioner differs from other commissioners' portfolios that provide specific focus through relevant pieces of federal legislation. International issues, human rights issues, including asylum seekers, predominantly sit with the President. Since my role potentially encroaches on the policy areas of other commissioners, and I don't want to unnecessarily duplicate anybody else's work, or more importantly, unnecessarily tread on anyone else's toes, my role is to focus on domestic, civil and political rights. When announcing my appointment late last year, the Attorney General, George Brandeis, noticed the absence of a rights-based culture in Australia and asked me to focus on advancing rights and freedoms, particularly the rights to freedom of opinion and expression. Resulting from my classical liberal approach to human rights and views about greater freedom for the individual, the Attorney General dubbed me the Freedom Commissioner. And I can assure you that is precisely what I plan to be. I want to advance rights and freedoms with complementary responsibilities for the individual. There are competing views about how we should approach human rights and freedoms. After all, they are entirely a political construct. I've made it clear I will be approaching human rights from a classical liberal approach, that human rights are the protection of the individual from the abuse of government power, that people own their own lives and pursuit of their enterprise while ensuring they do not harm others. Human rights are narrow and can be reasonably exercised consistently and that they rarely come into conflict. Human rights underpin people exercising their freedom. Since starting this role and engaging with many people, one point is clear. There is a fundamental lack of understanding about what human rights are. Commentators can ascribe their own reasoning. My conclusion is the lack of understanding comes from human rights being disconnected from their foundation principles. Sometimes worthy civil rights and social justice aspirations have been elevated to the sacrosanct status of human rights, and anti-discrimination has been conflated with human rights. I consider what I am about to say to be utterly uncontroversial, but it is not. One, human rights are not the same as civil rights. Human rights are universal and exist from birth. Civil rights are the gift of citizenship. Two, human rights are not the same as social justice. Human rights are about uncompromisingly protecting the autonomy of the individual. Social justice is broadly about advancing equity in society. Three, human rights are not the same as anti-discrimination. Apart from equality before the law, human rights can actually be about exercising discrimination, such as free association, whereas anti-discrimination is about removing unjust prejudice. Four, human rights are not about protecting groups of people. Universal human rights can only exist for individuals. By comparison, group rights can never be extended to everyone. In practice, universal human rights often conflict with these otherwise worthy aspirations. The four objectives I've just outlined are all broadly confused because of the development of treaties under the banner of human rights. It is understandable that countries sought to internationalise human rights values after the Second World War through international treaties. However, this process has disconnected human rights from their origins. Governments negotiated what human rights are, and they are no longer seen as birthrights. They are now perceived as gifts of government. And the UN system that has continued to add new human rights to the list has resulted in the dilution of their integrity. As argued by Daniel Hannan in How We Invented Freedom and Why It Matters, the internationalisation of human rights Europeanised them in particular. Hannan argues in his book, while the contents of the various European and international human rights codes are generally unobjectionable, the elevation of such codes to the detriment of national sovereignty and parliamentary democracy is wholly at odds with the Anglosphere tradition, the tradition that we come from. As a consequence, parliamentary democracy comes second to international jurists who establish new standards and challenge democratically elected governments and how they wish to implement a rights agenda. But from a classical liberal perspective, the much broader challenge is reconnecting human rights to their principled origins. In his History of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Austrian human rights lawyer Manfred Novak wrote about how Articles 19 and 20 of the ICCPR, they're the ones that talk about freedom of thought and expression, perfectly demonstrate the tension between the socialist and liberal traditions on human rights. According to Novak, in the liberal view, every individual has the freedom to form his or her own opinions from external indoctrination and to defend them in the free market of ideas without fear or oppression. The zone of legitimate state intervention commences at the point where the expression of opinion interferes with the rights of others or constitutes an obvious, direct threat to life and society. He then continues that according to the socialist view, human rights are, in general, the embodiment of the very essence of the socialist state and are marked by an objective conformity of interest between the citizen and the socialist society freed of class antagonism. Novak's analysis of the socialist view is infused with the rhetoric of the day. But the broad objective of the socialist view is to interpret human rights as an instrument to ensure democratic participation, not protect the universal rights of the individual. These are clearly inconsistent approaches. Yet this tension is infused through international treaties, which elevate worthy aspirations to the status of sacrosanct human rights principles. Defending freedom is merely the evolution of past intellectual debates about the relationship of the individual to the state. So to the extent that we are having freedom wars, it is merely the 21st century incarnation of the philosophical, political, and legal contest of ideas. The consequences of this are now being felt in Australian discussions about human rights. Human rights have been debased from their liberal tradition and have been compromised as the socialist tradition has become more pervasive. We need to press the reset button on discussing human rights in Australia, and that will be part of my role. I will be talking about taking a discussion about human rights back to their origins, and will be spending the next 5 years reconnecting them back to their foundations and their universal applicability. Human rights are the foundational building blocks of our liberal democracy. Human rights are not the same as freedoms. Human rights are the protection against government encroachment for the individual. Freedoms are the exercise of those rights. To that end, there are four foundational human rights that need to be strongly reasserted: freedom of association, religion, expression, and property. They are the forgotten freedoms. It probably seems odd to refer to freedoms we exercise on a daily basis as forgotten. But as foundational freedoms, they are being taken for granted and are consequently being compromised. Any compromise is rarely explicit. Instead, compromises occur through the incremental advancement of worthy objectives that encroach on our rights. As Human Rights Commissioner, I will be reasserting the primacy of these forgotten freedoms. I won't explore the breadth of threats to all of these forgotten freedoms tonight. I will have more to say about them in the near future and in separate speeches. So, Jared, you might have to accept you can have me back. But I will provide some cursory examples and provide a deeper exploration of the freedoms most relevant to contemporary debate, freedom of expression. On freedom of association, it is a universal human right to freely associate with others, but it is a right under pressure in the face of governments seeking to advance other goals. The most recent example is the introduction of the anti-bikie laws, which have criminalised free association in Queensland. Obviously, if individuals are engaged in criminal behaviour, the government should pursue their conduct to the full extent of the law. I should note that I have met with the Queensland government and they have provided a clear explanation about how they have implemented their laws. I do believe they have done so as much as possible to limit the impact of their laws on free association. But nevertheless, the laws still criminalise free association and do fundamentally compromise a human right. These laws are not alone. Similar laws are being considered in other parts of the country. And in the past, I've had to defend private associations that have gender-based membership requirements, as but one example. On freedom of religion, it is facing its own equivalent challenges. Since starting my role, I have met with representatives from a number of religious institutions. One of their concerns is the human right of religious worship will increasingly be narrowed to only cover activities on Sunday and inside a house of worship. Only last month, the Victorian Supreme Court of Appeal made a ruling broadly along these lines, and it hasn't got much attention. The Court of Appeal ruled that the exemptions for religious freedom under state discrimination laws did not apply to the Christian Brethren's Phillip Island camp when it sought to discriminate against a group that taught the acceptability of homosexuality, a teaching that was not contrary to the Christians, that was contrary to the Christian Brethren's faith. That group took the Christian Brethren to court, and the Victorian Supreme Court concluded religious exemptions should be interpreted narrowly. Challenges are regularly posed to religious institutions that accept taxpayers' money to provide services. It's clearly going to be an area of increasing debate. Property rights, I would argue, is the one of the most forgotten of all human rights. Of all the forgotten freedoms I'll talk about, property rights does appear to be the one that attracts the most response. It should be utterly uncontroversial. Article 17 of the UN Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that everyone has the right to own property alone as well as in association with others, and no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his property. Property rights are not just about physical property. Property rights are about people's ownership of their own bodies and lives, the use of physical property and land and intellectual property. Property rights are regularly compromised by legislation and regulation, such as native vegetation legislation, that restricts how legitimate property owners can use their land. As outlined, I will have more to say on these rights and the threats to them in the near future. as a consequence of government proposals, the most immediate of the forgotten freedoms to be discussed, and the one that I will outline in more detail tonight, is freedom of expression, or as we commonly refer to it, free speech. Freedom of opinion and expression provides the foundation for a free and democratic society, as is integral to the enjoyment of other rights, of the rights to freedom of assembly and association, and the exercise of the right to vote. Free speech is an essential human right in a liberal democracy. It is the extension of the absolute human right of freedom of conscience and thought. The High Court has established our democracy is actually built on free political communication. Free political communication also underpins the principles of transparency and accountability that are, in turn, essential for the promotion and protection of human rights. Free speech is the human right we exercise to defend all other rights. We are never called in to defend free speech from the excessive use of please and thank you. We are only ever called in to defend free speech when it crosses the line of social acceptability, and that's not going to change. The importance of free speech was highlighted by its inclusion as a second subject of Sir Robert Menzies' Forgotten People's speeches. Menzies argued, "So few of us have objective minds, detached minds, and what we conceive to be the truth is very often coloured or distorted by our own passions or interests or prejudices. Hence, if truth is to emerge, and in the long run to be triumphant, the process of free debate, the untrammelled clash of opinion, must go on." Menzies continued by quoting John Stuart Mill and his seminal work on liberty, and identified there is speech that can cause significant harm and can be legitimately curtailed. Despite not having explicit constitutional or legislative protection, Australia actually has a pretty good record on free speech. But it does not mean that we need be complacent. As already outlined, few threats to our freedoms come from deliberate curtailment. Instead, they come through incremental encroachments. The encroachments are often introduced with good intentions and often to advance legitimate policy goals. But not all encroachments are uncontroversial. Menzies identifies, like Mill and many others who have written authoritatively on the subject, there are limits to free speech, and they exist when they conflict with other human rights. For example, it is uncontroversial that people cannot use speech to imminently incite violence against another person. These are the sorts of issues we are exploring in the current debate about the Racial Discrimination Act and the now famous, it would seem, Section 18C that makes it illegal for a person to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate another person or group of people on the basis of race. As you are all aware, the Attorney General released an exposure draft of amendments to the Act in March, and that has sparked further debate. My views on repealing this section of the Act are well established. In a liberal democracy, we must approach free speech as a blank canvas where restrictions must be justified. We do not seek permission. In a liberal democracy, all speech is legal until it is made illegal, and definitely not the other way around. Censorship is not just an affront to the rights of the speaker, it is also an affront to the rights of the listener to hear, to learn, to be challenged, to inform their own views, to support and to oppose. There are legitimate restrictions, but in its current form, the wording of Section 18C is not one of them. To the extent that there are legitimate restrictions, they should apply consistently. If speech is inappropriate, it should not get special treatment simply because it relates to race. In its current form, the Racial Discrimination Act is a law that violates human rights and it must be fixed. Section 18C is also democratically dangerous. Under Section 51(26) of the Australian Constitution, the Commonwealth Parliament shall have the power to make laws for the peace and order and good government of the Commonwealth with respect to the people of any race for whom it is deemed necessary to make special laws. So long as the Parliament has the power to design race-specific laws, the capacity to limit discussion about relevant subject matters undermines democratic important participation. It is dangerous not just for those who seek to participate. It is also dangerous for the minorities that these laws may seek to impact. If the Parliament can legislate on it, we must be free to talk about it. And the assumption behind 18C is that different groups within the community cannot be criticised. I openly contest this proposition. One of my roles as Australian Human Rights Commissioner is to address human rights issues that affect the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex community. That requires speaking out against unjust prejudice, wherever it may exist. Yet the current act hampers my capacity to call out culturally ingrained prejudice in different ethnic communities in case someone is offended, insulted or humiliated. But in making the Racial Discrimination Act human rights compliant, it is important to approach the issue with considerable caution, to look back at the development of the law and to have an intellectually honest debate. We are not debating the acceptability of racism. Racism is always unacceptable. We are debating the extent that the law should tackle racism before it infringes on free speech. Even with legislative change, there is an ongoing need to provide complementary anti-racism programs, such as former Attorney General Philip Ruddock's introduction of Harmony Day to promote inclusiveness in the Australian society. However, there are a number of problems with defending the existing law. First, many have used a straw man to misrepresent the change that advocates seek. They argue that advocates for change want total liberty. In doing so, they have invoked the spirit of Isaiah Berlin's famous quote in The Crooked Timber of Humanity, quote, total liberty for the wolves is death to the lambs. It's a neat quote, but it does not accurately represent the debate we are having. There are many groups that seek change to the law, but they are not seeking to unleash the wolves. The government's exposure draft includes restrictions on vilification and intimidation, as well, of course, of a huge number of state-based laws that deal with the same thing. The argument is a straw man that is easy to set up and knock down, but is not intellectually robust. Second, many have argued against change because the introduction of Section 18C was preceded by three significant inquiries. The assumed conclusion is that these inquiries argued for the introduction of these laws. The reverse is true. The Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody recommended there should be a federal civil offence against racial vilification, but that should exclude, quote, demonstrations against the behaviour of particular countries, publication of performance of works of art, and the serious and non-inflammatory discussion of issues of public policy. The Royal Commission counseled for the definition of vilification to be based on the spirit of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which prohibits racial violence, discrimination, or hostility. Then there was the inquiry by the Australian Human Rights Commission's predecessor organisation, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, with their 1991 report from the National Inquiry into Racist Violence. In this report, the Commission called for the creation of a civil offence against, quote, incitement of a racial hostility and express prohibition of racist harassment, as well as federal criminal offences against, quote, racial violence. The Commission also recommended the creation of offence of incitement to racial violence. Finally, there was the Australian Law Reform Commission's 1992 report titled Multiculturalism and the Law, which examined the issue of racial speech. In recommending a civil offence, the Law Reform Commission supported making incitement to racial hatred and hostility unlawful. While it provided no explicit definition of racial hatred, it is clear that the intention was to focus predominantly on speech that could act as a precursor to violence. Even then, one commissioner dissented the recommendation and expressed the view that in a democratic and pluralist society, freedom of expression is of special importance, which may necessitate tolerance of obnoxious and hateful views which do not incite violence. Each of these inquiries clearly raises concerns about racism in Australia, but none come even remotely close to arguing for the word of offend, insult or humiliate, which later appeared in Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Rather, they raise the need to deal with vilification, hostility, harassment and violence. Any fair analysis would conclude that the recommendations of these three inquiries did not recommend the current law. This is not just my conclusion. The Parliamentary Library's digest to the 1994 bill that gave us 18C identified. in the case of civil offences, it was recommended that incitement to racial hostility, racial hatred or hostility, or racial vilification, or incitement to racial hostility be the subject of the civil offence. All of these descriptions involve a high threshold of serious conduct. The racial hatred bill, however, establishes a civil offence with a significantly lower threshold of conduct which offends, insults, humiliates or intimidates. The Parliamentary Library continued, "It is often argued that these three reports are the basis for the Commonwealth's proposed legislation. However, the Racial Hatred Bill 1994 is in some respects completely contrary to the recommendations of these reports." That was the Parliamentary Library speaking, not me. Third, there has been a constant implication that advocating for reform is inconsistent with human rights principles. Again, the reverse is true. Looking historically, the 1994 debate clearly shows that many human rights bodies were advocating against the spirit of 18C. The Parliamentary Library's Digest again outlined the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission expressly recommended against such a low threshold as would allow complaints for, quote, hurt feelings and injured sensibilities. Not that the Commission was alone. In its submission to the Australian Press Council, clearly explained that while the intentions behind racial vilification laws may be good, the reality is that legislation is not the correct method for tackling racism. Instead, it expressed reservations concerning the proposed legislation and recommended, quote, at this stage, being 1994, there is no need to introduce separate civil provisions, including because it would impose a, quote, chilling effect on free speech. In an article on 21 November 1994 for the Australian newspaper, Sir Maurice Byers argued against the introduction of these provisions as well. Byers' voice is particularly noteworthy because he was one of the lawyers that presented to the High Court and the cases that established the implied right to political communication in the Constitution, where he went and made similar arguments, as did the Victorian Council of Civil Liberties, the body that's a precursor to Liberty Victoria. On 24 February 1994, their representative Michael Pearce told the Senate inquiry, "We reject the notion that this legislation does not impinge on free speech. By definition, it must." To its credit, Liberty Victoria has broadly maintained this position. Defending human rights and wanting amendments to 18C is entirely consistent. The real question everybody should be asking is, where have the defenders of free speech gone? Fourth, international law has been invoked to argue the current laws need to be kept in place, including the provisions of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which limit any advocacy of national, racial or religious hatred that constitute incitement to discrimination, hostility or violence shall be prohibited by law. The other one is the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, ICERD. As alluded to in the earlier quoted statements of the Parliamentary Library, offend, insult and humiliate are not required by either the ICCPR or ICERD. Arguably, the Attorney-General's current exposure draft is more consistent with both the ICCPR and ICERD. Fifth, the larger number of complaints made to the Australian Human Rights Commission about racism in comparison to free speech suggests the laws are necessary. But such an argument is like comparing apples with fruit bowls. They only have a loose relationship. Unlike the Racial Discrimination Act, which provides an avenue for conciliation of complaints, there is no legislation for the Human Rights Commission to conciliate complaints on free speech. I suspect the average Australian recognises the futility of making a complaint to a body that cannot actually prosecute their complaint. In fact, the current complaints form used to register a complaint with the Commission does not even include a box where you can tick that your free speech has been violated, but there is one for racial hatred and racial discrimination. The closest there is a box you can tick that says, "My human rights have been breached by a Commonwealth government body." Further, racial abuse and freedom of speech violations are not the same thing. Racial abuse can be caused by any one of the 22 odd million Australians against any other of the 22 odd million Australians. Freedom of speech violations are primarily imposed by government and are weeded out through democratic processes. They are normally vetted through public debate, not conciliation. They are simply not comparable, and providing data on both gives no insight into the state of either problem. The sixth point about the defence used in favour of the existing laws has been repeating irrelevant poll data to demonstrate public opposition to change. As some of you may recall, less than a month ago, a Fairfax Nielsen poll asked the question, do you think it should be lawful or unlawful to offend, insult, humiliate someone because of their race or ethnicity? 88% said unlawful. 10% said lawful. The question doesn't capture the essence of weighted priorities. It would be foolish to rely on such a poll for public sentiment. If you compare it only to a Galaxy poll taken 3 years ago, which was asked, in your opinion, which of these two options is the most important? That the government protect the right to free speech, or that people are protected from being offended, you got the reverse result. 82% said free speech, 15% said protecting from offence, 3% said, I don't know. Commentators are welcome to draw their own conclusions, but it seems pretty obvious to me that Australians are a fair-minded lot who support freer speech when competing principles are actually proposed against each other. But even though I think this point supports my argument, I won't defend it. Using polling data to justify human rights violations is absurd. A central pillar of human rights is to protect the individual from the tyranny of the majority. Human rights exist beyond popular will. They are there to preserve people's rights against the tide of popular opinion. Seventh, and perhaps most importantly, there has not been a single human rights argument invoked to defend the current law. No one has a right to hear words they do not like. In fact, not a single human rights argument has been put up in defence of the existing laws, period. Inventing desirable freedoms to be free of certain forms of speech is not the same as a genuine human right. There are only two human right issues on the table: freedom of speech and equality before the law. I have said plenty about the former. Now for the latter. The current law allows for the assessment of whether someone has triggered offence, insult, humiliation or intimidation to be based on the attitudes of individuals affected by that speech. That necessarily leads to interpretations based on the identity of people making those comments. Subjective attitudes operate regularly within social conventions and norms. For example, it is understood that gay and lesbian people can use the term queer to describe themselves, but it is also understood that it's socially unacceptable for others to use this traditionally derogatory term. The same principles cannot apply in law without undermining equality before the law. It is utterly unjust that you can have two persons standing side by side, acting in precisely the same fashion, but because one is part of a group that their actions refer to, it is legal, but because the other one is not part of that group, they are outside of the law. These problems are exacerbated by the insult and offend low bar. It also assumes that censoring discussion on racial matters is the most helpful way to advance understanding. In an article last week, senior Indigenous leader Professor Marsha Langton argued against changes to assess whether somebody had been vilified should be assessed by an ordinary member of the Australian community. She wrote, "This could allow normative racism to be the standard by which allegations of racial or ethnic vilification are judged. Many Australians are simply not aware of when they are being racist." On both points, she is correct. That is why I've argued in my submission that any test should consider and take regard for all of the circumstances so that the first problem Langton identified can actually be overcome. But the second point, many Australians are simply not aware of when they are being racist, is particularly important. The solution to unintentional racism is not to take a subject off limits. Exercising rights responsibly was a theme touched on by Dr. David Kemp in his recent Alfred Deakin lecture at the University of Melbourne. Invoking the spirit of Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Dr. Kemp argued, "Liberal thought, with the wisdom of our democratic history behind us, tells us that a good society is created not by pursuing the illiberal with tribunals, punishments, and bans, but by the morality that grows out of the desire of people to be validated by the good opinion of others. It is this, not law, that has made Australia one of the least racist societies in the world. To properly exercise responsibilities, individuals have to be able to exercise their responsibility. To properly exercise their free speech, individuals have to be able to exercise their free speech. In advancing human rights, it is entirely reasonable to debate how the law should be changed. But the status quo is not acceptable. Of course, Section 18C is not the end of debating free speech in Australia. It is only the beginning. There are many other issues that we also need to discuss, from defamation laws, anti-terrorism laws, media regulation, freedom of information, and the competing property rights and freedom of speech interests in intellectual property, to name but a few. As I said at the start of this speech, in my role as the Human Rights Commissioner, I intend to promote a culture of rights, freedoms, and responsibilities. I will have much more to say about my work program in good time. But from the outset, I have set one clear goal, that no new piece of law will be introduced as a result of my time as Commissioner. Old laws may be reformed, but I do not want a new human rights law during my term of office. I do not want that to be what I hang my hat on. In Australia, human rights are advanced through culture and by ensuring that values and aspirations of people's rights to live is embodied in everybody. In the 18C debate, there is no dispute about the importance of tackling racism. The debate is about the extent that we use law to simply achieve that objective. As I have regularly argued, non-legislative measures such as codes of conduct and social norms are both more effective and more pervasive at normalising respect while avoiding the imposition of censorship. Instead, I want to strengthen the non-legislative defence of human rights. To that end, my first step will be to organise a symposium on free speech later this year. The debate around 18C has highlighted, one, how important free speech is, but there is also a desperate need for the importance of this basic right to be asserted. My objective in holding a symposium is to bring people together from the key interests in academia, civil society, the legal community, and business to put all free speech issues on the table. Identify where there are encroachments and attempt to build a new alliance on the need for reform. This symposium will then provide a roadmap for a government that has said it is serious about advancing freer speech. Similarly, in the second half of the year, I will also be commencing a national consultation on human rights issues in Australia Today, with a particular interest and focus on the forgotten freedoms. I'll deliberately be getting outside of the Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra triangle and going to the suburbs and rural and regional communities to understand the human rights concerns that they have. I want to hear if farmers feel their property rights are being undermined, where the freedom of association is being violated in suburban factories, and the extent that freedom of worship is being curtailed. I'll also be seeking feedback from Australians about how they are advancing human rights outside of law. I want models for advancing a rights-based culture through instruments such as voluntary codes of conduct which promote respect for others, drive cultural change, but don't corrode other people's human rights. These consultations will help inform me about the state of human rights in our great nation, and also how we can most successfully advance a culture of rights and responsibilities. I know it's hot, so I'll just say thank you for your time.
And so we come to questions and discussion. First, I should say thanks to Gallipoli Club for making this facility possible tonight, but also say if you're asking a question, don't stand in front of the camera down there. And we've got about 20 minutes, so people have got to be fairly brief. I may start off, Tim, asking the same question I asked Professor Triggs when she was here late last year about the Bold case and Section 18C, but it seems to me that the essential problem in that decision of Justice Morty Bromberg was that the judge complained not so much about what Andrew Bolt said, but the tone in which he said it, and to some extent what he didn't say, because the judge actually said you had to read between the lines. And as we all know, there's nothing really between the lines. So it was a question of tone and what he might have said if he actually had said it and not said something else. So to what extent do you think this 18C is a problem with a judicial interpretation, or to what extent do you think it's a problem with the legislation?
An excellent question, Gerard. And I think I'll first start by saying, and this is what I tried to bring out with the comments in my speech, is that it's not as though this law has never been controversial. It was controversial when it was proposed, when it was introduced. Earlier versions of it were controversial in 1992, which was proposed, and then it wasn't passed. So it's about the law generally, and I think there's a case to change the law regardless of the Bolt judgment, but you're right, part of the problem was the Bolt judgment, and I'm under no ambiguity that what's foisted onto public debate and public focus is that case. But it's not really about Andrew Bolt. It's about how that impact and that judgment has an impact on every Australian and what they can say. Is there a dimension of it that may be down to judicial interpretation? I think you can make that argument, but equally I don't think that the law didn't allow him, or the law did allow him, more importantly, to interpret it that way. The standards by which are established under the Racial Discrimination Act and 18C aren't consistent with other anti-discrimination law, which have a much different way of testing these things. Yes, it's about the looseness of the term reasonably likely, which can be interpreted in different ways and creates issues of equality before the law. But it's also about the low bar that was established. One of the arguments I hear regularly from people who want to defend the law is, in its current form, is that, oh, well, there's the way the courts interpret offend and insult is a high bar, and they set a higher bar than's actually written in the law. To me, that's an argument to change the law, because you've accepted that the judge is already reading it down and need to read it in a different way to make it acceptable, because if it was read based on what's actually in the law, you would actually have many more cases. So I think you're right, but I don't think we should ignore the broader structural problems with the law, and that when there are limits on free speech, it should not just be based on race. If it is a legitimate restriction on free speech, then it should be a restriction regardless of the attribute. Because, of course, as I keep pointing out to people, there aren't equivalent standards in terms of limiting public discussion and free speech in a similar way on issues around sexuality, around gender, around disability, or any other basis. State laws have a much more correct balance.
If in the next hour or two the government announced its intention to abolish the Human Rights Commission, if by some miracle that legislation got through the Senate, would we be in the lesser country?
Well, I would point out that, of course, we're... and I've said this in my speech, that I think that we defend human rights in this country predominantly through culture, but as well... through the common law. But I don't also think the Human Rights Commission can't have a place in advancing these causes, but it depends on how you want to see it. I know there are people who perhaps have a pretty negative view, but the legislation actually establishes a conciliation function to deal with these issues, and if it wasn't dealt with by the Human Rights Commission, it would still have to be done by another body. But that I don't think you're going to see that reality in the budget tonight, because in reality, the Commission, in terms of the total budget spending, only takes $18 million of core funding in comparison to many other programs, which I think will be much easier to cut back and not notice.
Is
it
Kristen?
Yeah. Tim, some people believe that this war is already lost. You talk about the Freedom Wars.
Yep.
Simply because the education system has accelerated this process of reinterpretation of human rights. Personal experience of this with my grandson, who gets very alarmed when he sees a sign to Blacktown because he thinks it's racist. So you know, it is really right throughout the education system. I'm pleased that you're getting out in the community, because I think that's, symposia are great, but they speak to the converted.
No, I agree with that, but I think, you know, we have to recognise that there are ways to use your resources most effectively. And symposia can be good, or national inquiries can be good for putting a grand focus on an issue and then taking it forward. But I think there are different components to what you've just discussed, which is there are always aspects of cultural norms that develop through our education system and are perpetuated through the education system and through other standards within society. My focus is on law, because law is more fixed and more rigid, and has a much bigger impact in terms of broader interpretations within society. But to the extent that there are freedom wars, I don't believe anything's lost, because every idea is always open to contest. Every idea is always open to be challenged. And when it comes down to it, I've been surprised, well, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, by the large number of people who, you know, encourage me to keep going on, because they do feel that the issues that are being raised are important and they need to be put out there, and that they don't feel confident of doing them themselves. There are so many issues that need to be addressed, and I don't think that any of them are off the table or any of them are unwinnable. That's why I said yes to the job and didn't say it was easier to sit in a free market think tank and be absent as much criticism.
The question there, you've got to be quick, yeah? Yes?
I understand your desire to stimulate debate, but what concrete are you hoping to achieve? So you said you've got 5 years in the job.
Yep.
Hopefully you do have 5 years in the job. And when it comes to 5 years and 3 days, and you're looking back and you say, this is what I've done, this is how I've changed,
yep,
what is that going to be?
Well, firstly, I basically can't be sacked. So if I don't get 5 years, it's because I died. So let's not think about that as an option. Of course, I think the Governor-General can technically dismiss me, but anyway, if anyone knows Cosgrove, so I'm a good guy. In answer to your question, one of those challenging things, because you come into this role and think, how are you going to advance the cause? And with our other commissioners, they have a much more rigid framework and a more specific focus, whereas mine, it's a bit more difficult, and I'm quite open about it. That's why I said partly you do actually go out and engage with people, because what needs to be done is we need to try and raise awareness about human rights issues, or my view is outside of the law, and how we seek to advance them. If that's better understood, more things are adopted, that would be an important thing to have achieved. But other things I'm going to develop as I go along, because events will present themselves, and there are some things that I do actually have a very clear idea that I want to achieve, but I'm not going to announce just yet.
I'll buy you a drink.
Yeah, buy me a drink. Events and circumstance need to enable the right environment to advance them. But if I can get a focus on that non-legislative measure and think people stop thinking the solution to all of their problems is law, I will be very happy in advancing that cause.
Question here.
Tim, so it seems to be a worldwide thing. The ATC is Australian, but I think in Europe there's also a huge PC movement. I think it's an American expression originally. And they have a First Amendment or some amendment that gives you free speech.
Yeah.
The thing that really worries me is that it seems to be related to identity politics.
Yeah.
You know, I have this, I have that colour, and so on. How do you see the relationship of that being stemmed in the political world that we live in?
Well, I think there has been a success in sort of postmodernist movement around people identifying as groups, and then that somehow rights should be attached to those groups. That's why I'm completely uncompromising in saying rights only exist for individuals. They don't exist for groups, because once you do that, you compromise the very basis of human rights. And then you get into a sort of bizarre inconsistencies which exist. You have to get up to a base of, well, what group outranks another? And I wrote about this, I think, late last year, before I got appointed to this, in my former hat, where I looked at being involved with student politics, where literally we used to take rankings of groups in which they could order, in which they could speak, and the extent to which their rights outweighed other people. This is real, and that's why that's the game you ultimately ended. Now, that's only if you try and establish these things through law. There is nothing wrong with trying to advance greater equity in society to the advancement of everybody, if that is your cause. But if you try and entrench it in law, you end up with those circumstances rather than what should be done, which is it should be done outside the legislative process to advance the common interest.
Okay, there's a question down the back and then over here. You've got to be very quick, okay?
Okay, my quick question is, talked about Sir Robert Menzies and how he believed that there were circumstances in which freedom of expression, ideas, etc., could be genuinely limited.
Yep.
May I ask you, do you, in your personal opinion, feel that he was justified, excuse me, in outlawing the Communist Party during his prime ministership during World War II, the same as how Pierre Trudeau during the October crisis did the same to the Quebec National?
The short answer to that is no. I think it was wrong, and I think it was an ill-advised decision. I can understand at the time why they might have thought it was right, but I think it's illiberal and it should never have been done.
Okay, there's a question here. Go be very brief.
Yes, yeah. I understand that at the moment, a politician in England who's standing for the EU Parliament
has been
charged before the law, fairly severe penalties if he's convicted, for quoting Winston Churchill. And a quotation from Churchill on a book he wrote on the Middle East was that, in his opinion, the Muslim religion provides social restraints on the society which might be beneficial.
Yep.
Now, how can you quote anyone?
Okay.
What can you say?
So the Churchill quote with the fellow in the European Parliament, and the answer is it's absurd that that would be the case. And I just shake my head and think of what happened to England, because if you go back and look at Menzies' forgotten speech, the one on freedom of speech, what he actually talks about is how England used to be the country that understood freedom of speech better than most. Now, whether or not he said anything particularly objectionable, I think Churchill's comments represent the time and the day. It's probably been poorly quoted in bringing them forward today in the fact that they weren't given perhaps the proper context, but that's his right, and it's stupid that he should be in that situation.
I should say briefly in defence of Menzies that when he banned the Communist Party in the Second World War, the Communist Party was allied with Nazi Germany, with whom Australia was at war, so it wasn't quite like what happened later. Okay, so there's a question here and down the back. Yeah?
You touched on something in the very last sentence of your speech. Has there been any serious consideration to renaming the Human Rights Commission the Human Rights and Responsibilities Commission?
No, because people don't have human responsibilities, they have human rights. Individuals exercise their rights, their responsibilities in response to rights, and that's the way it should be.
This question down the back.
Is it your thesis that the principles articulated about 250 years ago in a fairly simplistic English environment are really readily transportable to Australia in 2014?
So is John Stuart Mill really relevant, is the question?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. And if you just read these people and what they wrote in the Enlightenment period, it's quite clear that the principles they established today are the foundation principles of our liberal democracy and should continue to operate, because people can argue that they're not, but what's the alternative? If we're talking about something like free speech, the alternative is to impose censorship at different points. I don't consider that to be a viable option in a free society without serious democratic consequences.
You over here? Yes.
Raymond.
You've mentioned the consortium of Humiliate and ADT, whether we should use the reasonable person's test in such a situation. Whether it is reasonably expected to cause harm, and if that is that you cannot do this, if it is reasonably expected. So whether that test could lower allow both free speech and also protecting the individual.
Yep, so the question is about the reasonableness and good faith test as well. I'll chuck that in. Under the current law, which is not included in the Brandis draft that's been exposed to drafts put forward, and I don't believe that either should be included, because reasonable means that unreasonable, and lots of public discussion is unreasonable, and people have unreasonable opinions, should not be the bounds of limiting free speech. And the simple reality is that people engage in bad faith expression all the time. It doesn't mean people should do it, but the simple reality is, at least in heated political discussion, because people wish to characterise the opinions of their opponents and to advance their own interests, and often exercise bad faith. That is in itself not a justification, in my view.
The second last question. Oh, Dimitri, then Craig.
You touched on it in the earlier comments. What is it about race in Australia that warrants such protections when there are always rather classifications, religion, gender, physical disposition, age?
Question is, what is it about race that leads to these...
And well, obviously it did actually the broader issue of racism did come out of the three inquiries, which led towards the process of saying, let's do something. The inquiries didn't say do this, but that's what the parliament ended up doing. But, you know, race is, like for a lot of countries, has a chequered past in Australia. We shouldn't ignore that. We've had state-sanctioned racism in the past, and there are things that we need to do to repair that. My only argument is that the best way to deal with those things are outside of law and through education and various other mechanisms. But there are plenty of people who want to extend this provision further and to include other protected groups, which is when you end up with the situation the gentleman raised before, which is based on escalating group rights, which will only, well, fundamentally compromises individual rights, but ends up meaning you have to rank people based on how they're identified.
Craig.
If the amendments to ANC don't get through, where does that leave you in terms of your strategy for the next little while?
It doesn't affect my strategy because my focus is predominantly on the non-legislative parts. The government has thrown this political hot potato in my corner. And, you know, most people who come to the Human Rights Commission at least get a bit of breathing room and an opportunity to find their feet. I've had to find my feet pretty quickly. But the issue fundamentally won't go away. And it may take some time to reassert itself. But by focusing on those four core freedoms which I've outlined, these issues will continue to come up and will continue to be raised. And that's why I think the best thing for the government to do and the parliament to do is actually to address it, to change the law, to try and find a sensible outcome, which I think, you know, broadly the intention of the original exposure draft was to achieve. There are some issues which even I've raised which I think can be addressed and would address a lot of the concerns which hopefully should mean it gets successfully through the parliament in an amended form.
Did I miss someone there? Final, got to be brief, yep.
Yeah, so 18C of the laws are supposed to be preventative or punitive. 18C didn't prevent Cronulla or the Australia Day riots or the Muslim riots. As far as I know, nobody was punished for those things yet. Andrew Bolt was. Is 18C discriminatory against the intelligentsia versus the press?
No, I don't think it is. It's only about whether people choose to invoke it. And clearly some people choose to invoke it because they take exception to what some people say. That has been the case. And I think it's a very bad example. Sorry, a very good example or a bad example. You could really interpret either way of why you shouldn't have laws to use to this advancement. Because, you know, one of the classic arguments in favour of free speech is that censorship leads to martyrs of those who make speech. And people can judge that about whether or not, but regardless of whether you agree with Mr. Bolt or not, the simple reality is in this discussion he has partly become a martyr for free speech and for his opinion. And it's a classic demonstration of why you shouldn't use the law to shut people down unless there is an exceptional reason where there is a genuine human rights violation.
Many thanks, Jim. Well, there were some more questions, but we're right on knock-off time. I must say Tim Wilson's provided quite a lively contribution to this debate. I don't know where there's a morning tea down at the race discrimination place, but or the Human Rights Commission, I mean, but if there is, it must be pretty lively with you and some of your colleagues. At any rate, I'm glad you've given us a very lively presentation tonight on what is a very important debate. So I've no doubt Tim Wilson will be back in the future, but for tonight, for a significant speech, as your first major speech as Human Rights Commissioner, thank you for that and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.